I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, in anticipation of the upcoming Dig In Festival, we'll be talking about farm to fork. We'll be talking about eating smart and eating local. This is a show for the food lovers out there. My guests will be Neil Brown, a chef, entrepreneur, and Dig In founder, Tom England, also a chef and Dig In founder, and Todd Jameson, owner of Balanced Harvest Farm. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits at WFYI.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the statehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about farm to fork here in Indiana and Indianapolis in anticipation of the Dig In Festival. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits at WFYI.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are chefs and Dig In founders Neil Brown and Tom England and local grower and promoter of locally grown foods, Todd Jameson. Welcome all of you. It's good to have you here today on this beautiful day.
Thank you for having us.
Well, let's start a little bit. Let's talk about, first, what Dig In is. That's kind of our news hook for the show. Tom, I'll start with you.
Sure. Dig In was founded to really celebrate the foods that are grown here in Indiana and show people what we do grow in Indiana and how to get it. So we found restaurants from around the state who really specialize in using those local foods and bring them to the table. So, you know, as a festival goer, you can pay one price to get in the door and try food from really around the state, from the different producers and the different chefs around the state, and, you know, just have a good time out in the sun and enjoy all kinds of food and beer from around the state and wines from around the state.
And where did Neil, where is Dig In? I mean, if people wanted to take part, where do they go?
White River State Park has hosted us for the past 5 years, and just amazing partners. It has to be one of the most picturesque urban parks in the country, and it's just a beautiful venue for Dig In.
And if again, when is Dig In? We probably ought to establish that.
August 17th this year.
August 17th.
Correct.
So we're a couple of weeks away still,
mm-hmm.
And it's a one-day event?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, and if people want to do Dig In, how do they go about doing it?
Where do they
get information?
Yeah, they can buy tickets at our website at digindiana.org, or you can buy tickets the day of. That can be trying. Lines do get long, so I would highly recommend going on the website and buying tickets in advance.
Okay, and how much are the tickets?
$35 in advance. And I should warn, too, we do sell out. Our VIP tickets sold out over the weekend, so really now is your chance to go on to digindiana.org and purchase those tickets.
Okay, and how large a crowd do you get for this?
We cap it, actually, at 4,000 people so that the lines don't get too long so that people can get around and so the chefs don't have to produce, like, 6,000, 7,000 samples, but make it more realistic for them as well.
And Todd, could you talk a little bit about, you know, obviously having 4,000 people where you're basically, we're still several weeks away, and at least at one level they've sold out already. Could you explain the I'm not trying to make a pun here, the hunger for this sort of experience, this sort of dining experience?
Certainly local food is red hot right now. I don't think that there's a topic out there that stimulates as much conversation right now as local food. And people come about this from all different angles. Some people are interested in local food just because it tastes better and it's fresher by miles. Other people are totally into this because of health benefits or environmental issues or whatever their area of interest happens to be. There seems to be all these feeder tubes and connectors going back to the local food movement. So the ability to come out to Dig In and meet with the chefs and, more importantly, ask questions about where this local food has come from. Mm-hmm. The chefs that you'll find at Dig In are incredibly knowledgeable about Indiana agriculture, about Indiana producers. There's a reason they support a particular producer that they like to buy from.
Right.
We are talking about farm to fork, about locally produced food here on No Limits in anticipation of the Dig In Festival. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Let's talk a little bit. I wanted to get the information, obviously, about the festival out there first, but we probably ought to take a step back now and talk about why eating locally produced food, is important. Why at some level this movement? Because I agree with you, Todd. It is red hot. Whenever we do a show about locally produced food, you know, we get a lot of calls, a lot of emails and messages. There's clearly a real burning interest. What accounts for that?
I would say that the very first item to talk about is about the taste of local food. You know, we all have had that experience where you've gone to a supermarket or a chain store and you've bought a fresh fruit or vegetable off the shelf and it looks beautiful. And you take it home and you put it on the counter and you admire it. And you notice it's not getting ripe.
Mm-hmm.
And 5 days later, 7 days later, 12 days later, it's still hard as a rock.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't. Tomatoes this time of year. I mean, you cut right. into tomatoes from a grocery store and they're white in the middle still. But if you go to that farmer's market and you, like you said, that big ripe red tomato and you slice into it and, you know, you just start to drool as you look at it. That's what I get
exactly.
excited about.
Yeah. Locally produced food has the benefit of not having to be shipped rock hard and shipped from one side of the country to the other. A local product may travel 7 miles, 10 miles, 20 miles, maybe 50 miles from the place that it was grown. So the ability to grow vegetable varieties or fruit varieties that have more fragrance, more flavor, a softer texture, just makes all the difference in the world.
How do we define what is locally produced, Neil? I mean, you're as a chef, I mean, is it sort of a floating definition, or is there one that is sort of the standard that everybody uses?
It's definitely a floating definition. I think everyone has their own interpretation of what local is. For our restaurants, we consider local about 250 miles. So we're happy to pull down cherries from Michigan as long as they're being grown responsibly. Blueberries, of course. So you get these amazing berries out of southern Michigan. You know, you get some peaches out of, we get some out of southern Illinois, I think, and some mm-hmm. out of Kentucky as well. So, you know, we try to source as locally as possible, from the people that we know and the people that we work with a lot. But, you know, we like cherries too. So so when the opportunity presents itself, we're not shy about going to get them.
And I like how you said, is it a floating definition? Because, you know, based on the weather, things can change quite a bit. The cherries in Indiana, we lost 95% of the cherry crop.
And peaches.
And mm-hmm. peaches because of the late frost that happened. So, you know, for me to get local stone fruit or you know, any of those great tree fruits, I'm probably going to have to go out of state right now. And so, you know, we try to keep it as close to home as we can and you know, involve our neighbors next door, in this case in Michigan.
Now, I want to ask a question here. Is closer always better?
That's a I think that's a topic that is becoming increasingly important. Just because it's local, is it higher quality? And as a chef, that's something I pay very close attention to. I think it's going to be a conversation that's going to be had more frequently as more people interested in this sort of come into the market. You see more farmers growing than ever Some may be better than others. I'm not saying that's the case now, but certainly that could happen. It's like anything else. So, yeah, I mean, given the opportunity to buy local, I'm always going to default to buying local. That's just how I'm going to purchase. Luckily, we're going to have options as this movement increases, and we'll buy from the better producers at that point.
Well, and Todd, you're sort of on the opposite end of the, I don't want to use the term food chain here, but because it almost literally is. It's not a metaphor in this case. You're at the opposite. So I'm going to ask you the same question. Is closer always better? Because you probably have people who buy from you who aren't necessarily just around the block either, right?
Correct. And I would have to say local is not always better because of the very same things: taste, texture, the nuances of a particular product. What really sells it is the taste. Mm-hmm. And if the taste isn't there, I'm sure chefs, you would agree that if something just isn't right, you don't use it in your kitchen because only the very best makes it across your kitchen. So, you know, in Indiana, we also have another challenge about local, and that is that we live in a state that's blessed with a wonderful climate and fantastic soil, but we're surrounded by tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of acres of commodity crops, corn and soybeans, mm-hmm. which leaves very little room at this point in time for the production of the more what we would refer to as edible crops, the fruits and vegetables. And, you know, we're very excited to see all the growth that's taken place, new farms coming online, new farms springing up every year. We see that all as very positive. But at this time, for this broader definition of local, there's a reason so many of our purveyors and suppliers have to go out so many miles from central Indiana to bring product back to us.
Mm-hmm. What will it take? Well, A, is it presumably the farmers who are growing the commodity crops are doing so because, you know, they find that it easier to make money that way. What sort of changes in the economic structure would have to take place for that to change?
Obviously, there has to be in real-world profit. Mm-hmm. out there to drive this, to sustain, you know, everything today is about sustainability. And, you know, the economics of farming are such that you have to be able to sustain yourself. But it's also a changing culture. The kind of the commodity grain type culture is very large scale oriented, whereas the fruit and vegetable business and livestock farming sometimes can be a very small scale business where it's actually boots on the ground every day, 18 hours a day in a field working somewhere with your hands out in the weather, and it takes a different type of a mentality to want to do that.
In your case, and you're probably not going to want to, you know, divulge your balance sheet or whatever, would you be making more money if you were doing the commodities crops? I mean, I'm assuming this is a passion for you.
Absolutely. I would say yes. Certainly there is more money to be had at this point in time in the commodities.
So you're swimming, to some degree, the local food movement is still swimming upstream, even though there is this kind of pent-up demand for it. Is that fair, Tom?
Yeah, it's interesting right now because I'm starting to see a lot more people come in and saying that they want to switch from commodities to more of the vegetable and you know, market-driven stuff. And it's interesting to have these conversations because, you know, the farmers are saying they can barely eke out a living at 250 acres of commodity crops. And, you know, that's just enough to really break even at the end of the day. And so with that large volume, you know, it changes. When I can change just 2 acres of that land to vegetables, then I can make much more of a profit from those vegetables.
And, you know, in terms of does that make it difficult then, Neil and Tom, as chefs, to find what you want, the locally grown, responsibly grown you know, vegetables, fruits that you want?
It's just changed. I wouldn't say it makes it more difficult to find by any means. If you're you know, doing your homework and you know who these people are, then it's not difficult to find. But the market's changed because a farmer can now take their produce to any farmer's market, sell it at retail, and literally walk or, you know, hop in their pickup truck and drive home with no produce left. Whereas if they're selling to restaurants, there's a lot more legwork involved. And not only that, but they're dealing with people that are negotiating on price. People at farmers markets don't negotiate on price. They walk up, they pay what you're asking, and they walk away happy. Chefs also have a profit margin to protect, and so therefore we have to negotiate a little bit on price sometimes. So the market's changed a bit. You can still get fantastic stuff. I mean, it's readily accessible as a chef restaurateur. We have access to the best stuff. Mm-hmm. But the market has changed. The general consumer also has access to this stuff now, too.
We are talking about Farm to Fork in anticipation of the Dig In Festival. My guests are chefs Neil Brown and Tom England, and locally grown food pioneer Todd Jamieson. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about Farm to Fork here in Indiana in anticipation of the Dig In Festival. My guests are chefs and Dig In founders Neil Brown and Tom England, and local grower and promoter of locally grown foods, Todd Jamieson. Well, just before we went to the break, we talked to some degree. We haven't used this word yet, but it really came down to sort of trust, how you can trust the food, too, the fact that the chef has negotiated for it, that there is a face-to-face connection there. How important is that in all of this? I'm going to let all three of you have a shot at that. Todd?
Oh, I think it's amazingly important, because if our local food environment is to grow and to thrive, it's still in a seedling stage now, but there has to be authentic food. Mm-hmm. The consumer has to be able to buy with confidence or shop with confidence, mm-hmm. and know that they're buying it from the person who produced it, or in the case of a restaurant, buying it through someone that knows the story of that food, because we're all drawn into this from different angles. Some people because of environmental issues. Some people are highly sensitive to the GMO, genetically modified organism side of things. Whatever your area of interest is, in the local food movement, you can ask that question face-to-face from an expert who can give you an answer. And if they can't give you a reasonable answer, it's time to move on and find and connect with someone who does have the knowledge that you're looking for.
Neil.
Yeah, so on our side, the relationships that we have with our farmers is incredibly important. For us, it's all about trust. Mm-hmm. The reality of it is we can't be on the farm. And so we do actually try to get out to farms. We just took a sort of a field trip with all of our chefs out to Tyner Pond Farms about a week and a half or so ago. So we do try to visit farms, but we can't visit them all, especially not in season. And so we have to have a certain level of trust from who we're buying from, just like the consumer does, as Todd was just saying. So, you know who the good producers are. Chefs talk, everyone talks, we learn, and so we rely on those farmers to be have their boots on the ground to provide us the best stuff.
Tom, Neil says that the chefs talk.
Yes.
What do they talk about? I guess would be the question there. Then there's a network.
I don't think you want to really hear what we talk about a lot of times.
Not on radio.
I mean, we share sources and you know, really talk about where food is coming from. And in some cases, it's where food isn't coming from when somebody says it is coming from there. And you know, we really need to. It's a buyer beware society. I mean, we need to know where our food comes from, and you need to ask the questions. And if that is, you know, asking the server or the restaurateur, you know, where's this food coming from, it's important. Even in the grocery stores, to ask, where's this food coming from? And a lot of people don't realize, but a lot of the grocery stores even will change their sourcing based on what customers want. And so it's always important to go out and ask, you know, could you get this from somebody else and have more local food available? And I should say at this point, too, that, you know, Dig Indiana or digindiana.org is the website. Dig In, the festival is for chefs by chefs. And so we looked at this and said, you know, how do we promote all these restaurants that are using local foods? And so we went out and found the sources of the food, talked with the restaurants, and actually we pay for every bit of the food that is sourced locally for that festival as a festival organizer, so that the chefs aren't stuck with a huge food bill to be able to produce the samples that they do. And that way, you know, the restaurants still volunteer their time and their hours to be able to do this, but they're not going to go bankrupt from buying all the food that's needed for it. We also know the sources then of that food and make sure that it is being sourced locally.
How do you create that network, though? I mean, mm-hmm. I'm presuming you're starting something, in effect, from scratch here, right? Because mm-hmm. you have to start, like, developing relationships with people like Todd or whomever. I mean, is there a hub or a network that you use?
That's what we're creating, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, as chefs, believe it or not, it's a pretty small sort of segment of Indianapolis. I mean, we do all know each other, literally. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know almost all the working chefs in the city, and I know most of the working farmers in this city. And Tom, being with Ivy Tech, gets to sort of see all the young talent coming through, and as they grow and become chefs on their own, he maintains those relationships. So the network. Oddly, has been the easiest part getting to know all these people, because it's just...
Well, I'm thinking about a network, though, in which, you know, like, how do you identify, Todd, who you sell to?
You know, it's very much the same answer as the chefs give. We are kind of a really close-knit food community. And when you look back 10 years ago, who was out there and who was involved, it was a core group of people, and it's grown out from there, so that the networking is readily available, but you have to be a part of it.
With the development of Dig In, it has been really interesting for me to really see a different part of the farm world too. You know, I grew up in a small farm family when I was younger, and then just working as a chef, you know, I was always working with small local growers. And then as we started Dig In, we started working a lot more with different farmers as well, because of the different restaurants. Not everybody is going to have the price point where they could go out and buy, you know, heirloom Berkshire pigs from Tyner Pond. Mm-hmm. And so in some cases where they're selling food at a lower price, which we still support those guys, then we had to go out and source food that they would normally use. And so... Getting to know the people at the family of farmers and to really grow out a network of non-heirloom type varietals as well. It was interesting. And you mentioned earlier the local and is local always better? And,
yeah.
You know, that's the question that I would always ask. And sometimes you have to go out and you do buy stuff from larger producers here in the state. And there are definitely larger producers in the state.
We are talking about Farm to Fork in Indiana, and specifically we're anticipating the Dig In Festival in a couple of weeks. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Got a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air. It says, do any of the chefs, I guess... either of the chefs in this case, use produce grown from urban farms in Indy?
Yeah,
definitely.
Absolutely.
Nodding your heads is not good for radio.
Yeah.
We actually need words. We need words here.
Yeah, between Pizzology and the Libertine Liquor Bar, we purchase from Growing Places Indy. We purchase from Matthew Josie, who's a great urban farmer. So, yeah, we buy a lot of stuff from urban farmers.
At Ivy Tech, our program actually has a garden on site where we grow most of our own lettuces, for sure, and many of the other vegetables. So, I mean, right there at 28th and Fall Creek, we're growing quite a bit of our own stuff.
Now, given that this movement is kind of exploded. I mean, does the demand exceed the supply right now? Mm-hmm. I mean, is there, Tom, you were the quickest there.
Yeah, and Neil alluded to this earlier. I mean, a farmer can sell vegetables at retail price all day. And yeah. So for restaurants to be able to buy wholesale, it's impossible. And so, you know, that's why sometimes you'll see in a lot of the restaurants that are using the local foods, I mean, it seems like a higher price. And that's because we're paying retail for most of the vegetables that we're buying in the restaurants.
I want to ask a little bit, step back from this sort of global piece of this, because it struck me with this. Almost always there's a conversion story somewhere along the way here where somebody decided, you know, the food I'm eating or whatever either isn't good for me or it just doesn't taste good or whatever. And in Todd, in your case, you not only made a choice about, you know, the food you were consuming, but also, you know, how you were going to make a living and all of that. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, I grew up on a family farm in the Garden State, New Jersey, and grew up as a conventional farmer. Never met a chemical I didn't enjoy. Made life easy. Dependable yields. Everything was great. It wasn't until later in life, when I had a few experiences and a couple of health issues arise, that I started to take a step back and look. And had a very dear friend who, doctor of entomology, and she kept saying to me, you know, you need to be looking into organic production. And I thought, oh, my goodness, that's never going to work. Well, after some research, after some studies, after some trials of growing conventionally and in an organic style side by side, I soon saw, well, this is possible. And that did cause me to go through a conversion of seeing that there's a whole nother side to this world of agriculture that I thought that I knew on a very intimate level. There was a whole new side to this, that there was a cultural change about to unfold. And we've been fortunate enough to be a part of that change.
Mm-hmm. Neil?
Not so much a conversion for me, but sort of a reinforcement. I was able to, after Tom and I actually had lunch with Alice Waters in Indianapolis, I had the opportunity to go out and spend about a month in Berkeley. And two weeks out of that month, I spent cooking at Chez Panisse. And which is a venerable farm-to-fork restaurant, maybe even one of the leaders of that movement in the 70s. And what struck me in Berkeley was that everyone serves farm-to-fork food, but they don't talk about it. Mm-hmm. And that was very interesting to me. It is a foregone conclusion on restaurant menus that what you're eating is coming from the closest possible source, and they don't really advertise it. They don't market it. It's just there. And that was a departure from fine dining. Has always been that way. Fine dining, you're expected that you're serving local, very, very high quality product. In casual to you know, even less casual restaurants, that hasn't always been the case. So I definitely have seen that over the years. So. You know, I've always been a believer because I have a fine dining background, but that really reinforced it, that you can have a casual restaurant such as Pizzology and serve local product.
Mm-hmm. Tom.
Yeah, and, you know, I think people make this slow conversion really to knowing more about their food and, you know, eating locally. For me, you know, it was starting to think more consciously about the food that I'm consuming. And then I happened to read Barbara Kingsolver's book, Animal Vegetable Miracle. Mm-hmm. And through reading that book, it just kind of impressed upon me how big of a deal it is, actually, to eat locally and how much it impacts the community and really how much you grow as a community by knowing your farmer. And so we committed to trying this for a year and seeing what happens. And that's been 7 years now that we've at home consumed everything from really at this point within 50 miles of our home. So, you know, it's something that did not happen overnight. It just kind of happened naturally and I might say organically. and it really has changed who I am, obviously. I mean, I'm a local foods activist. I'm proud of that. And I want to tell people how good that the food is that's being grown locally.
Yeah, never turn down an invitation to eat at Tom's house.
We are talking about Farm to Fork in anticipation of the Dig In Festival here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Tom, actually, I want to pick up on that because there's a moment, you know, in some ways now food has kind of become what, you know, what music was in the 60s or whatever. I mean, I'm struggling to figure out a term to use here for it, but it's become a real statement about who you are as a human being, what you value.
Yeah.
You know, when did that happen? It's, you know, in particular because Sneal says, you know, the idea that at least in fine dining or upper-end restaurants, that you're going to eat something that hasn't been frozen for a couple of weeks or whatever before it gets to you is not exactly revolutionary. But it is in some places now, and it's become almost, you know, people talk about it. You know, Tom just identified himself as a local foods activist. Mm-hmm. When did that transformation, when did it become kind of a cultural, almost political statement?
You know, in Indianapolis, it's been really interesting to watch because it's really happened in the past 5-6 years that you've seen people start to realize that, you know, we're not just a chain city, that there are other things there. And then all of a sudden people started talking more about, hey, have you been to Libertine or, you know, these other places as a status symbol almost that, hey, I found this place that isn't a chain. And all of a sudden that really encourages other people to start opening up businesses. And it has really just encouraged the growth of local business. And during the economic downturn, people start to look into themselves and towards their neighbors. And I think that is a huge part of it is you know, during economic times when people don't have money, they want to make sure that they're spending it in the right ways. And that means, you know, knowing who's getting my money and that they're doing something good with it. And I think that's huge when people start to support their neighbors.
And it's become a personal definition question, really.
Absolutely. You know, Tom just answered that question from that perspective. But Tom also told me a number of years ago that it's actually the home cook who is the trendsetter in what happens in the world of food. And I believe that that's absolutely correct. With the downturn in the economy, more people eating home, having friends over, cooking together. There's been a revival in home canning, which if you would have suggested that 15 or 20 years ago, people would have laughed at you and called you a lunatic. But it is a rage now to reintroduce home canning. So everything that's old is new again.
We are talking about Farm to Fork in anticipation of the Dig In Festival. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you. Hi, I'm hearing a lot of talk, and actually there were a couple of comments just made about supporting local businesses and how mindful we have to be of our money. And I'm guessing that most of the listeners right now are not surprised by hearing that about how important it is to spend their money locally and to support local agriculture. I'd just like to comment that goes far beyond agriculture. It goes to our other local businesses, our construction, our education. It goes to our local politics. You know, we get caught up in our state and our federal politics, but how important it is to be engaged in our local politics as well. And if we can just bring our minds back to the local community, including agriculture, man, it's going to make just such a much, much bigger difference in our greater community. So thanks for all you guys are doing.
Thanks very much for the call, Andrew.
And I totally believe that's true. You know, politics are all local, and as much stuff that's going on internationally and even, you know, at the federal level, the thing that impacts us most are the county councils and the school boards. And, you know, just be mindful of what's going on locally I think is huge. Spend more than time just thinking about food. Think about, you know, the clothes that you're putting on and where they come from as well.
Yeah, the environment in all forms and shapes. We are talking about Farm to Fork, locally grown food, in anticipation of the Dig In Festival, which is coming up in just a couple of weeks. My guests are chefs and Dig In founders Neil Brown and Tom England, and local grower and promoter of locally grown foods, Todd Jamieson. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about farm-to-fork, locally grown foods here in Indiana in anticipation of the Dig In Festival. My guests are chefs and Dig In founders Neil Brown and Tom England, and local grower and promoter of locally grown foods, Todd Jamieson. Got a couple of questions about Dig In that I'd like to get. One of them is, will there be vegan options there, Tom?
Ooh, vegan. I know we have a couple of vegan options. Most chefs on the vegetarian side will, even if they're doing a protein-based dish, they'll do it without protein so that if somebody is vegetarian, they could ask for a vegetarian option at that location. The banners that are above the tents that show what the chef is doing have a little symbol on it that says whether they can do a vegetarian option or not, which makes it a lot easier for somebody who's vegetarian so they don't have to wait in a line and get up to the front and realize that they're not doing a vegetarian option. So all they have to do is look for the little vegetarian symbol on the sign and in the passbook.
Neil, any?
I would just say that I'm certainly seeing vegan diets growing in numbers, and so it's certainly something that we're going to have to look more into with Dig In.
So probably not immediately. They're a vegetarian, but not necessarily vegan.
I certainly wouldn't count that out because I know a lot of people are just doing vegetables just because it's the middle of summer. So
okay.
I think there should be lots of vegan.
Yeah,
options.
I'm actually looking through the list of some of the dishes now, and there are several that are vegan. Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, it's just like the population. We have to have a variety of stuff based on our population. So in general, we try to keep 8 to 10 dishes that can be done in a vegetarian way. You know, that really represents the population who attend.
We've also gotten a listener question via email, and if you'd like to reach out to us via email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. It says, can the guests share some restaurant participants, mm-hmm. including the chef's own restaurants? We probably ought to give you a chance to plug your own places here.
Go for it, Neil.
I'm sorry. I'm not sure what the question is.
Oh, what are some of the restaurants that would be participating, including?
Oh yeah. So.
And you can plug your own too.
Sure. You know, chefs that you would recognize, like Cerulean, of course, will be there. Black Market with Micah Frank. Rook will be represented. Carlos Salazar. I believe.
There's
Our Bistro will be there again this year. Recess mm-hmm. will be there again this year. So those are sort of the well-known restaurants. Tom, do you want to?
Yeah, I just want to say, too, in the VIP area is where we'll have all the James Beard nominees from the area. So Neil Brown will be there with Libertine in the VIP area, as well as Regina from Our Bistro and Recess and Blackbeard. But we also have smaller manufacturers, restaurants that are here as well. And so, you know, Natural Born Juicers will be doing Zen and Cherries and even some food trucks like Scratch Truck and Duos and, you know, just a huge variety. New Union 50 is going to be there. You know, they just opened, I think, within the month even, and they're going to be participating. You know, from Terre Haute, we have Jay Ford's Black Angus and Circle City Sweets and Circle City Soups will be there. Circle City Soups, I'm really looking forward to. They're doing a dish with, it is called Huevos Rancheros Nachos. It's phenomenal. I've had the opportunity to have that a couple times in the past month. So, you know, all kinds of good stuff. And, Even B Java Roasters, B Coffee Roasters, is doing a cherry coffee zing that you can get, and a hibiscus refresher from Omni Sevron, and all kinds of fun stuff.
You really don't like food at all, do you,
oh.
Tom? Not at all. I can tell that there is a significant passion in your voice. We've gotten a question via Twitter, and if you'd like to send us a tweet, you can do so at WFYI. It says, can you really eat local food year-round in Indiana? Neil, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think to Growing Places Indy's Winter Farmers Market is a great place to start. But, yeah, by all means, you know, Todd brought up a great point that the home cook is really the pioneer of this this food preservation that we're seeing so much of these days. In fact, it's actually a little difficult to keep up in a commercial kitchen. But canning and other forms of preserving make it very possible to eat year-round local foods. I mean, Tom is a testament to that.
And you know, it is a matter, or it has been in the past, a matter of canning and freezing and keeping that stuff through the winter months. Last year, with it even being 20 below zero, I was growing arugula in January, just under basically a tarp that's over my garden. So, you know, it's definitely possible, and there are a lot more food growers now that are growing in greenhouse through the winter. And so now in the wintertime, I can go to the market and get fresh vegetables that are growing in the ground. They're just under glass.
Got another listener question. How do you know how much food to buy for your restaurant?
Mm-hmm. I have a two-year degree that you can get at Ivy Tech. I'll teach you all about that. All right.
And I would also say that if you can figure that out, come work for me. you know, you just look at trends. You get a feel for what business is going to be like on any given week, and our chefs do a great job of doing that.
Yeah, and then with local food, too. I mean, we're getting in stuff that needs to be processed, and so you know, there's what's called a book of yields. So we know that, you know, if I bring in an onion, I'm going to lose 40% of that when I peel it. So things like that.
Yeah, and you get very creative as well.
Yes.
We've gotten an email question. It's an interesting one. This is from Jennifer. And again, if you want to join the conversation by email, send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. I want to know from Neil or Tom, on most menus that talk about a specific local product being used, what happens when they run out of that local product? Some establishments substitute with a non-local source. Others change the menu. What is Neil's position on this?
Both. If we cannot get it locally and we're not in a position to change the menu, changing a menu is actually a pretty expensive endeavor. So to change an entire menu because you can't get one ingredient, it's just not viable. So, you know, again, we just go to that next layer out as far as distance. And we try to do that as well as we can. Again, we always default to as local as possible, though. So we also have the opportunity of changing those ingredients. There's a reason why restaurant menus are leaning towards reading more vaguely these mm-hmm. days. It's so that we can have some sort of
flexibility
with those ingredients. And so we will be able to swap out, you know, Lucanato kale for some other kind of kale if necessary.
We are talking about locally grown food in anticipation of Dig In here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You also can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Or if you want to send us an email, as William did, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Do your guests know that a century ago, acres of the south side of Indianapolis were under cultivation and under greenhouse glass growing local produce mm-hmm. for the local market? Two organizations, German Gardeners Mutual Benefit Association and the Marion County Greenhouse Growers Association, still exist and are members of the Federation of German Societies of Indianapolis that owns German Park. They owned and operated the farmers market at South and East Streets for decades, now part of the Lilly campus. We have a long history here. Todd, you are nodding your head in affirmation here.
You know, Indianapolis has one of the greatest stories to tell about urban farming, and it lasted longer here than it did in many other cities. We still are just so privileged to have Pieper Brothers just down on Bluff Road. I believe mm-hmm. they are the largest producers of purple top turnip east of the Mississippi River, possibly nationwide. They are amazing farmers, right? Mm-hmm. Of all the things to yeah. be known for. Mm-hmm. But bravo, Pieper Brothers, outstanding growers. This city has a remarkable history. And as I said, everything that's old is new again. All of a sudden, we're experiencing urban farming. Yeah. What many people didn't know is that probably as close by as 50 years ago, 40 years ago, there was a thriving vegetable production 12 months out of the year mm-hmm. right here in our city. And how did we lose that knowledge, or how did we let that knowledge go away?
Yeah.
And we need this to come to the forefront.
Well, and I'm listening, Todd, I mean, it's obvious you have a tremendous passion for this. What does it give you? I mean, you could just eat, you know, locally produced food and leave other people to do it. What do you get out of producing it yourself?
Yeah. I'll tell you, I can answer that best with a story. When I was 16 years old, the New York City Green Markets opened for the first time, 1976. And there was a woman who would come into the market every Saturday and buy a gigantic bag of green beans. And after 3 or 4 weeks of buying this gigantic bag of green beans, she came back and she said, "I suppose you're wondering what I'm doing with all these beans." And I said, "Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I am." And she said, "I grew up in the South and I was raised by my grandmother. We lived on a farm. And I've been gone from the South and my grandmother's been dead for many decades. But what I'm trying to do is share my grandmother's culture with my children. So every week I take this bag of green beans home and I try to recreate her recipe. And I don't have her recipe. And I just want to tell you thank you today, because for the first time in many years, my apartment smelled like my grandmother's kitchen. Gosh. And it took me back to time and place. And one of these weeks, I'm going to get this right. And I want to say thank you to you." Wow. And that was a turning point for me as a 16-year-old to see that something that I took for granted, something as ubiquitous as food — we were surrounded with food 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And this woman thought that those green beans were the most special thing, and she wanted to share them with her children. Mm-hmm. And that was absolutely a monumental moment in my life.
Gotten another question by Twitter that's a follow-up on the question about the menu item. If it says, "If food is suggested to be local in the menu, do you tell people about the change when you make it?" Neil?
Boy. No, not necessarily. If it's a sort of a what I would call like a horizontal substitution, where we're getting it just from another farm, then no, we wouldn't make that. If it's a substitution of a like ingredient, we probably wouldn't. If we don't get it locally, we're going to be way more apt to actually change the menu item, frankly. We don't always, and no, we don't. If it has to change, then we just make that change.
Is it tricky, though? I mean, in the fact that because you are doing it locally, and Indiana, like most places, has growing seasons for specific things, it does mean you have to change the menu fairly frequently. I mean, this is not like a chain restaurant where you're eating the same stuff year-round.
Yeah, we're doing a salad tasting between all the chefs tomorrow. And one of the guidelines for the salad tasting is the ingredients in the salads have to be available locally for the next 6 weeks. And that would be our next menu change. So, you know, we set those guidelines up. We're able to plan pretty well. So, you know, if we can foresee what's coming down the pike from a seasonality standpoint, we're usually pretty safe.
And I think it's important to remember, you know, every chef's going to have different thoughts on menu design and mm-hmm. how often menus are printed and mm-hmm. you know, how specific you are on the menu. You know, I think if you put a specific farm on the menu, you have to be truthful in that. And you know, if you make those changes, you have to let the consumer know. Mm-hmm. And that's why most of the menus now are not specific to the farm or the manufacturer. They're they're more vague in saying local greens in this case, or lettuces, so that they can make those substitutions in the restaurant.
Yeah,
so
I will say that if we list the farm on the menu, then that product always comes from that farm, no matter what.
Yes. Is there a temptation at all to do what, you know, in some places in Europe, I mean, the menu is a blackboard. Because they know it's going to change from day to day.
Definitely.
I have heard it said many times, I know if it's going to be good food if it's written on a blackboard.
Yeah.
Well, we've also gotten a tweet via Edible Indy. How does Neil support Indy Food Council local food fellows?
I don't currently.
Probably ought to explain what those are.
Tom, maybe you can explain better.
So the Indy Food Council is a group of people from the Indianapolis area that support local food and access to good food. And, you know, Indianapolis has horrible food deserts, very large food deserts that mass parts of Indianapolis do not have access to good food. And that means that the person who wanted the food would have to travel more than 20 minutes to get it. Mm-hmm. And in many parts of the city where people don't have good public transportation or cars to be able to access it, it would take 45 minutes to go to the store and back. So Indy Food Council helps with a lot of that. And Indy Food Fund is generated through that council to give grants to groups to be able to help them support those efforts. Dig In actually was recipient of one of the Food Fund grants so that we could help chefs get access to some of the food and be able to do grow outs. So one of the things that we're doing with that grant is having grow outs of things that are heirloom and heritage here in the state. So you were talking about the history of food here in the city. White River State Park, where we do our festival, was chosen because of its history with food.
Mm-hmm.
So where the zoo is used to be a big, large China Poland hog farm. And so this variety of pig was known for its really thick, lard fat cap on the top of it. And back when lard was the main source of oil for anybody who cooked. And so that breed was really developed here in the state of Indiana and helped to develop the city. Big rail lines were brought into where White River State Park is now, where they would process those hogs and ship those buckets of lard all over the world. And so, you know, we're trying to grow out now that China Poland hog. And so that, you know, next year you'll start to see on restaurant menus again China Poland hogs.
We've got just a few seconds. I'm going to ask for Dig In. What are you most looking forward to? Is there a dish or something that you're looking forward to? Tom, start with you.
Oh, well, that's a really tough question. There's so much good food. I don't know that I can answer that, Rifan.
How about if I kick it to Neil real quickly?
Oh, yeah, I love all the food, but I love the experiences more than anything else. I really enjoy being able to it's one day out of the year where all the chefs can get together in one place, and that's really very true. And so we just love getting together.
Real quickly, give the URL again so people know.
Digindiana.org.
We have been talking about locally grown food here on No Limits. I'd like to thank my guests, and I also would like to thank our listeners. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.